This is CKMS Radio Waterloo on 102.7 FM, and you're listening to From the Void. Now, those of you who have been in the void for some time will realise that I'm not the usual voice. My name's Perry Urban, and I'm standing in for Chris Sherin today, although he will be here in just a moment. What we're going to do today is we're going to be listening to Chris's music, which goes out on Bandcamp under the name Deaf by Design. And I have to say, it's absolutely amazing music. Almost every album, well, every album is brilliant. They're all different. There'll be some that you like, there'll be some that you don't like so much, but you'll definitely find something that you love if you dwell in the void like I do. So, what we're going to do is we're going to listen to some of his tracks, we're going to talk about them. We will no doubt go off on various tangents to other things, but that's all okay. And we'll manage to fit it all into an hour. We might have 2 hours, we might have 3 hours, we don't know right now. But that's what we're going to do. So without further ceremony, we'll bring Chris in and we'll start to do what we're going to do. So hello, Chris.
Hello, Perry. Thank you.
So how does it feel to be on the other side of the microphone, as it were?
Well, I got to admit, that was flattering. That introduction was, thank you. I really, really appreciate that. So I got all sorts of warm and fuzzies right now. so it feels great to be on this side of the void.
Well, you were very kind to me. So I feel as though I should repay the compliment, but it's genuine. I really, when I first came across your music, and it's quite unusual to find somebody who is so similar in what they do. And the way I sort of see it is, you've got a black beard, I've got a white beard, and so the way I think of it is we're like that yin and yang symbol, with the white, okay, and the black, you know. Because I think your music is a bit darker than mine. Is that fair to say? Oh, would you agree with that?
100%. Yeah.
Okay.
My music does tend to go there.
Yeah, it does, and it's brilliant because I wouldn't do that bit of it. The kind of darkness, the angst that's so apparent in what you do. I don't really have that in me, but it's great for me to hear it in someone who produces music which is not identical to mine by any means, but is in the same sort of area, in the void, as it were. We're both in the void, but we're different shades of colour within the void, which I think is great. So I've chosen a number of tracks, and I don't know whether we'll get around to all of them. But before we start that, I would like to know, and maybe the listeners would like to know as well, a little bit of your background, what you did, because I noticed when you sent me the list of your material that I think you started recording this batch of material in 2015.
Yes. So
everything you've done, I think there's about 14 albums or separate works, 9 different projects that you've done. So some albums are in multiple parts. And that's a fantastic output over that period of time. It means effectively 2 albums per year, which is pretty good. And so what were you doing before 2015? Where I would like to start with you is your first musical experiences, whether it be listening or playing or sudden realizations of, wow, there's this thing called music. How was that for you as a kid?
I grew up in a very musical household. And not musical in the way I'm musical. Like, there was no instruments in the house. There was just a really good record collection and a good stereo. And I had complete access to it, you know, before I could walk and talk. So, like, a lot of my original encounters with music, I don't even really remember. They're more like being told to me. Like, I have a photograph of me at an age where I was just standing up. I'm wearing like a onesie, and I got these giant Pioneer headphones on with the curly cable on it, you know, and holding a copy of 77 by the Talking Heads, and I'm listening to Psycho Killer, you know.
Wow.
So apparently, like, before I could speak, I'd be walking around the house going fa 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 fa, you know, because I dug the Talking Heads so much at that age, apparently.
And so that was at the age of 7.
No, no, this would have been like 3 or 2.
Oh, 3. So, sorry, even younger than that. Wow, that is quite early, isn't it? That's Mozart style.
Yeah, I guess so, right? And so this is, and I don't know, like, what it is that I, what piqued but my parents decided that was the album I liked. Like, obviously, I must have had some weird body movements or something while they were listening to the Talking Heads, so they stuck with the David Byrne for a bit. But that's like the earliest musical thing that I kind of know about as far as my parents talking about my love for music, you know. But I remember my earliest memories of listening to actually putting a record on a turntable myself would probably be closer to 4 or 5 years old, and that would be News of the World by Queen. You know, I loved hearing We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions back to back, you know. And my parents used to do recreational activities after work or like during the week, you know, like curling or playing darts, that kind of stuff, right? So they'd get a babysitter, which was a kid up the street who was a teenager who would look after me and my brother, right? And he loved 80s metal, you know, so he AC/DC, you know, Midnight Oil, Def Leppard. You know, he'd love that kind of stuff. And Thunderstruck by AC/DC had come out like that week. And he brought it over on a cassette tape and put it in my dad's stereo. And we listened to the song. Not Thunderstruck. It's The Razor's Edge is the name of the album. But the song Thunderstruck is on there. And yeah, so he puts it in the tape player and plays Thunderstruck for me. And I'm hearing it like brand new, never heard. And I knew AC/DC because I liked the song Dirty Deeds and the Done Dirt Cheap, you know, off of one of their... I guess one of their first albums, I think, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But anyway, I had heard them on the radio and whatnot, but this Thunderstruck thing just sent electric charges in me. And the babysitter, his name was Scott. Scott had gone home and left the AC/DC tape in the tape player. And I listened to that thing on repeat for like 7 days till next time he came to look after us, you know? And he took it home with him. And And I don't know if there was a profound effect on me, like I was moping around or whatever, but my mom went and bought me the CD like that shortly after that. And that was the first CD I actually owned, because, you know, CDs were the thing when I was growing up. And this was like, here's the CD for you. And I still have that. I still have that CD. And it's...
That's brilliant.
And yeah, and so that was where like my musical journey started for me, was AC/DC. Like my first personal, like, this is my music. You know, I had Zappa and Floyd.
Yeah, do you, before we move away from AC/DC, do you still think they're cool? Do you still have the same sort of reaction to those songs?
Oh, well, it's funny that we're talking about it right now, because I'm in the middle of recording a cover of Thunderstruck. And there's no guitar in the song. It's all synthesizer. So it's a... it's
right, Kraftwerk style.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually by accident starting to sound a lot like a Gary Numan song. So it's an exciting Gary Numan song.
Yeah, I guess that's not so far from the truth, is it? That Gary Numan is a kind of a mix between the electronic and the heavy rock a lot of times. He goes for those big sounds, doesn't he?
That's
interesting. So when did you... So that was your first sort of formative experience of, wow, this music's just blown my mind. So going forward, when did you begin to think about, these guys are playing instruments, could I do that? Do you remember that moment?
Yeah, I think I do. It wasn't long after this AC/DC moment, maybe a year or two later. So I'm getting to the age of like 7 or 8 maybe, and I'm in school. I'm, you know, in grade like 2 or something or 3, you know, like very young. And there was this kid in the playground, because our playground was shared with kids that were up to like 12 years old or something. There was this kid that was like 12 or 11 that had a guitar. I can't remember I think it might have been an Ibanez, but it doesn't really matter. He had a guitar with a battery powered amplifier, and he had it like on his strap or something, or on his belt or something. And he would walk around playing like Thunderstruck and Eruption and stuff on it, you know, and probably very sloppily, right? But it was, I knew he was playing Thunderstruck. I knew, you know, I knew Eruption because my dad had that first Van Halen record, you know, like I knew these riffs. And he's playing, you know, Smoke on the Water, and he's playing Iron Man, you know, he's playing all the best guitar riffs ever, you know. And I saw that and I was like, I want to play guitar too. Like, why don't I have a guitar with a battery powered amplifier, you know? And one of my friends that was in my neighborhood where I grew up he was a couple of years older than me and a couple of years younger than him, but he knew this kid, and he also wanted to play guitar. And so his parents bought him a Squire Stratocaster, and he had an old giant PV amp that weighed like 100 pounds. And he started playing these riffs on his guitar, you know, you know, and so I'm hanging out with him. I could walk to his house from home, right? So I'd hang out at his house and he'd play these riffs on his Stratocaster and I just would want to play, and he'd hand it to me and he'd try and show me how to play chords and stuff. And I just didn't have it.
Right.
Like it didn't feel like it was in me, you know, like the ability to play it. So I kind of shunned away from it, you know? And then when I kept showing interest in it. Like I really wanted to play guitar. And I think around 10 or 11 years old, my mom, I guess, had this acoustic guitar that was laying around that she'd won in a contest or someone had given her. I forget the story as to how she got it, but it was like a very low end, like harmony guitar. And she took it to the local guitar shop and got them to try and straighten the neck out the best they could and put new strings on it and, you know, polish it up and tune it up. Mm-hmm. And then for Christmas, I got this old guitar with an old songbook with like John Denver songs and Bob Dylan songs in it and stuff,
right.
with those plastic flexi discs in it, you know, with
right,
the, yeah. to help to tune your record with, you know, you put on, you know, that's how you tune your guitars with the flexi disc record.
Yeah.
And so I got those two things in a case with like a note saying, guitar lessons every Tuesday or once a week, you know, was my
wow.
Christmas present that year.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and that was like, so I took these guitar lessons with this teacher and he wasn't very good. He showed me how to play Thunderstruck. He showed me how to play, you know, Iron Man and all these riffs that I was still envying playing,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't really go beyond that. He just kept asking me like, you know, what Guns N' Roses song do you want to learn? What, you know, what this song do you want to learn? You know, and I remember he was obsessed with Slash too. He thought Slash was the greatest thing in the world. And,
oh, wow.
So he was a cool guy, but he was unreliable. He didn't always show up to the lessons. And I felt this yearning to just want to play guitar. I didn't feel all that satisfied playing these riffs. And I don't know what it was in me, but his method of teaching wasn't grabbing me and I wasn't practicing. I wasn't taking it mm-hmm. seriously. You know, it just wasn't, really happening. And
so
then,
what age, just orientate me here. What age were you at this point?
About 11, I think.
You're 11. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when I was getting closer to 12 years old, or maybe I was 12 at this point, my mom had revealed to me that my great grandmother had passed away a few years earlier, and she, someone for whatever reason, there was $1,000 put aside for me, and my mom
right.
was supposed to spend. My mom was supposed to spend it on me without telling me, to spoil me with $1,000 randomly
right.
one day, but she didn't like that. She thought that was a dumb idea, so she just put it in the bank and decided till there was a moment where that screamed, "Here's the money," kind of thing. So
right.
I didn't like playing this acoustic guitar. It was hurting my fingers. I wanted to play an electric guitar. I figured that would be like the thing that would push me into wanting to play guitar more. So I got the Pacifica. She told me about the money, and then I went and grabbed the Pacifica. I got a little amp and I bought a set of golf clubs because there was enough money left over to get a set of golf clubs. And I was a very keen golfer at that age too.
Good.
So that was it, right? So I got the Pacifica at 12 and this other amp. And I remember I played, I did a few more lessons after that and he disappeared. He just stopped teaching, whatever happened. He just disappeared, that teacher. And then the owner of the music shop where the practice rooms were, where I was getting taught in the basement, he decided mm-hmm. to take me on as a student. And he was a much high level. He was a very high level teacher. Like he was,
mm-hmm.
he could probably teach guitar players that we know and respect, like Dave Gilmour, and make him a better guitar
right.
player. You know,
right. yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Technique and tips and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and he was the one that like taught me scales and how to play chords and really pushed me into theory a little bit. But it was too much. Like what he was giving me was too much. And I don't think he actually wanted to teach me. I had a feeling that he was doing his best to make the lessons as painful as possible so that
really?
I wouldn't want to come. I got that impression. Now,
wow.
that could be me just being a lazy 12-year-old kid that rather play video games than guitar at that point in my life, you know? Or
yeah, maybe it was a case of tough love. You know, if you really want to play the guitar, you're going to get through this and you're going to play the guitar. But if you're just pretending and you don't really want to, then this will put you off and you can go and live your life and do something else. So he was maybe testing you out.
Yeah, absolutely. He might have, you know, because it did break me. Like I, after those lessons, I didn't play my guitar much. It sat in a closet. And it wasn't until grade 9, which would have been like, I was 14 years old, maybe 13 or 14.
Uh-huh.
So not much longer, but at that age, a year and a half, 2 years is a lifetime.
Oh, it's
a huge
difference. You're now into
yeah.
the zone where you're beginning to establish lots of parts of your identity, but your musical identity is beginning to really take hold. And yeah, that, I was that age too when it all happened for me. It was a sudden revelation, you know. And I like you, I wanted to know everything about music, and I wanted to just absorb as much as I could, and I listened to it all the time. And yeah, I'm guessing that was what you did too, was it?
Absolutely, it was. Because even though I'd lost interest in the guitar for a bit, my interest in music was skyrocketing. You know, because around that same time I was playing guitar, I started discovering more of my own music. You know, because even though AC/DC was my favorite band, they didn't feel like they were my band. They still felt like something that came before me, right? Yes, so then I started listening to like the Smashing Pumpkins, and I started listening to Marilyn Manson. You know, these musicians that became famous in my time. You know, and mm-hmm. and I was starting to listen to more radio music, like getting into stuff that you were hearing on pop radio rather than on classic rock radio.
And how important were your peers at school? Did you get? Was there a group of you, or was there a kind of a feeling about music at school? Were people bringing records in or CDs or whatever?
There was a bit of that going on with the CDs. I was the one that was the most musical. I was the one that always had headphones on and was showing people what I was listening to. I don't remember the same thing happening to me very much. I was the one usually
doing
it.
Right, so you were the guy that I saw at school. I wasn't that guy, but there were guys that were like that. Always had the new records. Always had the latest thing, and would enthusiastically try and turn everybody on to the latest thing. I'm 20 years before you, so it's a completely different kind of music, but it's the same idea. You know, and the beauty of the album, the original vinyl, was that they were big, so you would walk into school with the album under your arm, you know, and everybody could see you walking in with the new Genesis album or whatever it was, you know, and it was like, ooh, he's got the new Genesis album, and great excitement. And there was a little record player in the 6-year common room. This is 1976, and you know, the records were put on there, and there was a crowd of about 20 people all sort of trying to listen to this tiny little monophonic record player, and getting very, very enthusiastic about all of these new bands and things, which as you discovered for yourself, they become your bands. You know, there's something you've discovered by yourself. It's quite powerful.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember bringing the album, because you know, like carrying the CD case around, it may have been in my backpack, but I don't remember showing off the album artwork, because it probably wasn't as important by the time it got that small for most
That's
people.
True.
But it was more, it was just like you'd have the portable CD player, and I'd have that CD in that CD player for a week until the next one came out, or if I just got sick of it, right? But yeah, same kind of deal. Yeah, so I guess I was that guy. But
yeah, you were that guy. That was good. I didn't have access to. I didn't have enough. My parents were not into music and didn't think that I should have anything to do with music. It was the opposite to you. So I never got. I never got any sort of help with that. So I had to wait until I was earning money before I could buy my own records, which was a bit later on. Shall we listen to the first track?
Absolutely.
And then we can maybe pick up the story later on. Well, folks, the first track we're going to play, I think, unless Chris has any major objections to it, we'll find out, is a song called Nothing Left to Spare from an album called The Carnival Creepshow, which I think was the first of this sort of tranche of music that you made. So if I got the timeline right, this is one of the earliest things that you recorded. Is that right?
This would be part of that album. This song was actually recorded later on in the album, even though it was the first song in the album. But it definitely is in my first like 10 real serious like solo songs recording by myself. So it is very early on that way. Yeah.
I shine.
Wow, that's, I love that track. That's great. So when, while the track was playing, we were chatting away and you were telling me about the organ sound on there. So tell the listeners all about that, because that's fascinating.
All right. So my wife, her grandmother used to have this Hammond Romance 126 organ. And it's a transistor Hammond. You know, it's not like a super sought after unit. On the used market, they're quite affordable. And it was problematic too. It had its problems too. Like, not everything worked on it the way it was supposed to.
Everything analog had its problems. Let's say.
Yeah, that's true. So I would, you know, her grandmother had passed away, her grandfather passed away, and it needed a home, or it was going to be disposed of, I assume, or go some other place. I'm not sure. So she asked me if I could house the organ for her, you know, and give it a home. So we brought it to my house and set it up, and I remember I was playing it and whatnot, messing around with it, get some sounds, and I liked the sounds, like that sound that in that song there, that's the sound I had. And I went, this is nice, like this is usable. So I just instantly just grabbed some mics and ran some cables, you know, from one room to the next, because it wasn't in where my studio was, it was in a different room of the house. So I had to run all these cables to it, and I remember the cables weren't quite long enough, so I remember I had the organ like on an angle in a very awkward spot in the room just so the mics would reach it. And yeah, and I remember I ran like three or four long headphone cables joined together to get my headphones into the room so I could listen to a metronome in my ears so I could play in time. Mm-hmm. And because I knew I was feeling that tingly stuff you were talking about, where there's something in this. There's this instrument speaking to me. I'm feeling something creative happening inside me right now. So let's just do it. And I started playing some chords. I can't remember what key it's in, you know, but I remember playing some chords and they sounded really smooth and it was kind of repetitive. And I just recorded them a few times in a row. And I remember I had two mics set up. One was like a large condenser, one was a small condenser, on either side of the Leslie inside the speaker cabinet of the.
So it had a Leslie speaker. This organ.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it had the spinning.
Tell people what a Leslie is, because some people might not know what that is, and it's quite important.
Okay, so a Leslie speaker. I don't know the importance behind the name, but it's basically just a speaker that rotates inside of its own cabinet. You know, so it's always spinning. You can typically control the speed between slow and high, and it just creates this.
So for those who haven't grasped what this is.
Okay, yeah, you do a better job than me.
This is not a plug-in. This is a physical speaker. How big was it? A couple of feet wide, something.
Yeah, because it was built into the cabinet of the.
So it's built into the cabinet of an organ, and it physically like a. I don't know how many pounds and weight that thing would be, but it's actually physically spinning around on a motor, which gives you that wah, 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 wah kind of sound.
Yeah, and it was a horn, I'm pretty sure.
It was a horn. Yes, it is. It's a horn that goes round and round. That's right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What a fantastic sound, though.
It was, yeah. And it gives you like that spinning sort of like phaser effect you know, and it's a classic sound and Deep Purple Records and Vanilla Fudge and the guys that utilize the great Leslie sounds and whatnot. Now, this wasn't one of those organs. This organ, you couldn't do Deep Purple on this organ or Vanilla Fudge because it's not a tone wheel organ. But it had like more of a churchy vibe to it. But I liked it. Like, it was nice. So I recorded that chord progression, a couple different chunks of it, and then just looped it. So I would go back, go into the studio, set it up on an 8-bar loop or a 12-bar loop, whatever the loop was, and then went back in and started recording. Like, I flipped some switches on it and made the Leslie go faster, and I started playing the more melodic lines, right? You know, with the same microphone set up, but with the, you know, just different settings on the unit over top of the chords.
And you're doing this entirely on your own, and you're rushing back and forth between the recording situation and the performance situation. So you've got to start the recorder, run through to the room, wait for the count in, do your bit, run back, stop the recorder. Yeah, I mean, people don't know the pain that we go through to make the. That just sounds. Sorry to insult your integrity, but that sounds like a plug-in. It sounds clean and nice, but it's got that. I know that it's got that kind of organic, kind of instability to it, which now that I know it's real, that's why it sounds like that.
Yeah.
So that's absolutely fascinating. Now, I wanted to say something about this track, because to me this track's a great example of breaking the rules. Because if you said to anybody, that I believe is a 9.5 minute long track, and I don't know what the listeners thought about that when they were listening to it, because if they're listening to the radio show, they won't know how long that track's going to be. And when I tell them that it's 9.5 minutes, some of them will be astonished and they will think, that surely was only 5 or 6 minutes at the most. No, because what music does is it takes you out of yourself and you're breaking all the rules because it's two chords for the whole song. I think, am I right in saying that?
I think it is. I think you're right. It's just two chords.
Yeah, I marked it because I thought, well, what is it about this song that attracts me so much? That's the first rule that you've broken. You can't have a 9-minute song with two chords. Well, it turns out you can. And the bass drum, which I love because it occupies such a big, it's like Ja Wobble played a bass drum. It's huge. It's boom. It booms out. And again, that's, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to keep the drum nice and tight and keep it in the groove. No, you can break the rules if you want. And then all of your extemporizations that you played on the organ, and there's guitar on there too, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is somewhere, yeah.
There's almost guitar always, and there's other bits and pieces. And then the cherry on the cake, of course, is the vocal performance. And I wanted to put this track first because it does feature a brilliant vocal performance, which is something you picked up on when you listened to the first track that you played on the show that you did for me. And to me, that's the thing that makes that track absolutely shine, because there's something going on with this guy. I don't quite know what it is, but we were talking about it as we were listening to it, and there's that point where you slide the note down the way, and I just get chills. You know, it's quite a high pitched note, and it just slides down the way, and oh, and it just sets up the track wonderfully, because after that, you know, you're in good hands. And to me, that's one of the jobs of a musician, is to say to the listener, I know it's weird. I know it shouldn't work. I know you've been told that this is bad music. I know you've been told that, but just listen, because I'm going to take you on a wee journey here. 9.5 minutes, two chords, a skanky old organ that my granny used to own, some extemporization, me on my own, rushing between the two locations to try and get it done. Absolute genius. Absolute genius. I love it. I love it.
I really appreciate that. And and I'm glad you hear it in it too. Like, it's because it's, you know, it does might not jump out at someone what's happening there, but you clearly got it. I like
Yeah, I think that's something I would love to know. I mean, I don't know if I've ever met anybody who listens the way that I know that you and I listen. I know my friend Bobby, who was in the band with me, he listens very closely as well, and he'll pick up on things like that. So he's one, but he's a musician. And what I would love to find is people who listen the way that we listen, but who are receiving it rather than being part of making it. Because if you're a musician, you're always kind of thinking about the process, even if you're just enjoying it. When I listen to Yes or Pink Floyd, I'm always in my mind thinking, yeah, they must have mic'd that up this way, or they must have done this or done that. And it would be great to hear from listeners who just listen and appreciate the kind of things that we're talking about. So it'd be great if anybody's listening to this and you're like that, you're in the void, you love being in the void, you love this kind of music, let us know, because we'd love to know how your mind works when you're listening to music, because we know how our mind works. Because basically Chris and I have the same mind, just in two different bodies. It's very strange. The next song I'd like to play is something called Afterbirth from iRobot Volume 1.
Yes. Yes.
Now this is a bit different. I think we should just go ahead and listen to this and then we can talk about it after. Is that okay?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. Thank you.
that was disturbing, to say the least.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about how you constructed that and what was going through your mind as you pieced that together?
Yeah, so that piece was much more intentional rather than like a flow, like the other song. So the other song came out of me spontaneously, like an improvisation of creativity, whereas this song here was a calculated move using different audio tools and me going for a particular vibe, right? So I had just recorded the song Afterbirth, and this album's a story, right? The iRobot story. So Afterbirth is the fifth song on the album. So like the first handful of songs are setting up this idea that it's okay, or it's possible and normal now, to be able to merge your consciousness with a machine and become immortal by becoming a robot, essentially. So at this point, the transformation's happening, right? So the song called Rebirth before Afterbirth was sort of like this thing being turned on. The robot's sort of like understanding it's a robot. It's a human in a robot. It's got these feelings and abilities to sort of move around. It's not, I don't nail it on the head with this. It's very vague and cryptic the way I explain it, but it was more of an idea in my head. The music was supposed to portray the idea more than the lyrics. So it's hard to understand the story without hearing it. But so when I made the Afterbirth song the Rebirth song, I wanted something that was like almost polar opposite to come afterwards. And foreboding or foreshadowing this darkness that's going to be that unfold throughout the album, because the album's not a happy story. Like the immortality ends up being a darkness, right? And this consciousness in the robot wants to escape and die, because it wants to be, you know, realize that death is as important part of life as living is. You know,
I remember reading your liner notes or your notes on the Bandcamp page, and it struck me that you're actually quite a skilled writer as well, in the way that you put that plot together. And I didn't have enough time to parse the whole thing with the music, because I was obviously preparing for the show and that's just being professional and all that for the first time in my life. And but I appreciated the story, and the story seemed to be pretty well fleshed out. So did you have the story before you started making the music then?
The story was the excuse for the music, right? So one technique I use in these songs, all the songs have a bipolar feel to them, where they go from being a very human sounding song to a very robotic sounding song, or vice versa. And the robotic sounding technique I came up with was an accident, where I was programming drums one day and accidentally dropped the drum MIDI into a VST like instrument, like a piano or something.
Ah, right. Yes.
Right. And yes. I was fascinated by how that sounded. It was out of tune because the drums aren't programmed to be in key.
Of course. Right? Yeah.
But the rhythms were insane. Right. I was like, this is like, because they sounded inhuman. They sounded robotic. They were very jarring. And I thought, wouldn't it be neat if I wrote music for robots or by robots? Or music for robots by robots. And that sounded too stale to me to have a whole mechanical album of mechanical music. So I wanted it to be more organic and have this like yin and yang type thick quality to it. So it was, so the idea, I was like, I didn't want it to be like humans versus robots, like in the Matrix sense. I kind of wanted it to be this, I don't know what it was. I think I just watched that movie Transcendence with Johnny Depp, where he merges his wife's dead wife's consciousness into a robot. It doesn't go well.
I've not seen that one. Is that a good film?
No. I recall liking it. I don't know. I was probably really stoned. I'd probably barely remember half of the story because I was thinking about music instead. You know?
Yeah.
But it was, I remember like being, it set a seed in my head. So I wanted an excuse to write robotic music. So I wrote a robotic story that had humanoid aspects of it. So I wanted the story to reflect the way the music was coming out of me at that time. So you
write the story first. Is that you get the idea for making this music? You write the story. It's about a couple of pages long. It's not a novel. It's the sketch for something that could be made into a novel, or it's the scenario of something. But then so as you're making the music, you've got that in mind already.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and it became self-fulfilling, right? So as I leaned on the idea and the theme, the ideas were coming out of me, and the songs were kind of coming out of me. So it was nice. you know, and it right. was, so not every song might, not every song had the same musical intention that it mm-hmm. appears to have in Afterthought. You know, so the songs didn't come out to me in this order. So I would apply the songs to where they fit best.
The process is informed by the exactly. writing that you've done. And then then all of this kind of comes out and it all makes sense. Well, that's brilliant. That's a great moment to go on to a track from Volume 2, from I, Robot Volume 2, which is a track called Ragebot.
Thank you.
so that was Ragebot by Deaf by Design from the album I, Robot Volume 2. And I have to say, that screaming, I want to ask you about the screaming and about the vocal technique. Were you born sounding like that, or did you have to rehearse, or was this, how do you get something like that?
I've always enjoyed the sound of my own voice, whether it's talking or just annoying people, like just making mouth noises. So as long as I can remember, I was making noises like that and trying to sing AC/DC songs when I was a kid, you know, and whatever. I would imitate the sounds of helicopters or the sounds of revving engines. You know, I just like making mouth noises. Not like the way a scat musician would or whatever, or an a cappella guy, but I don't know. So when I was in my high school band, they were joking about, oh, wouldn't it be really cool if we could cover a Disturbed song? And I said, Disturbed? I could do Disturbed no problem. That's nothing. And they're like, what? Yeah. You can sing like that? And I didn't realize until that moment that that was something not everybody could do. Like, I thought everybody could sing like yes. that. But just, yeah. why not, right? You know, so so for me, I just always had this ability to push my voice into very strange directions, whether it was a confidence thing or whether it was just me just always doing it. I don't know. Chicken and egg. I'm not sure. So yeah. It was just, it's like walking.
So it's always, so that's interesting. It's always sort of been there, yeah. waiting to spring upon us in this track. This track is one of the ones I think that is most like that. I haven't listened to everything. I haven't yeah. listened to everything that you've done, but in my listening to find the tracks for this show, that was the one that stood out as being the most. What would the word be? It's kind of testosterone driven. It sounds to me. It sounds like it's male anger, frustration, angst. You know, is that what's going through your mind when you're doing that?
Oh, a little bit. Yeah, like I was just feeling really angry the day I wrote the song. I was, you know, I can't remember exactly what it was happening in my life that was making me upset. Either women, work, or friends. You know, the usual. You know, and
yeah.
And it was just, I needed something cathartic. There's a song like that, similar to that song on the album before it, the Carnival Creepshow, that has, it's called Black and Blue. And it's got a similar guitar tone and start and stop kind of like guitar approach to it. And I think, so I kind of wanted to approach that sound again, because I didn't feel like this was like another attempt at writing a song that's in my head that never comes out, right? And it was also, it fit the storyline perfectly and what I was trying to do. And I was jonesing some real thick fuzz on my guitar. So there was a lot of just like primal urges, testosterone type urges that made those decisions anyway, you know, so definitely testosterone fueled that way. And like I mentioned during the song, when we were chatting, that Songs for the Deaf by Queens of the Stone Age is one of my favorite records of all time. Like, I think it's a masterpiece, like Dark Side of the Moon level masterpiece.
Yeah.
And they, and that album is a concept too. And that album, is about driving through the desert, listening to the radio stations between Joshua Tree and Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. You know, and he was recording another album, and these are the songs he was writing for the next album in his head while he was listening to driving through the desert. Uh-huh. And, you know, and it's written by a bunch of guys that like to get drunk and eat mushrooms and hang out in the desert and write. Like, when they make it, they have another band called the Desert Sessions. So that's what they do. They get drunk and high and on psychedelics. And they write music until they can't stay awake anymore. And that's the album. Like, yeah. whatever they recorded yeah. while they were still awake, that's the next album. Sometimes it's two albums or three albums come out of that one yeah. recording session. And it goes anywhere from punk rock to psychedelic music to anywhere. It's very adventurous. So that was a big inspiration on me, the guitar tone. The screaming is definitely more my own thing. Like, my voice, the musician that inspired me the most to be free with my voice like that would probably be Marilyn Manson, which I don't know if
of
that
course.
Seems apparent or yeah. not. Yeah. Yeah. You know, my voice, I have a very similar
Manson's,
voice.
Manson's got that, I don't listen to Manson, but there's an Emigrate album where he does a track, and it's amazing. He's got a kind of sepulchral sleaziness to his voice, which is quite unique.
Yeah, it is. You know, and anytime I sing like that, like just let my voice go, people pull me aside and go, hey, are you inspired by Marilyn Manson? And I am, but not like, I'm not trying to sound like him. I just realize there's something in our throats that are shaped similarly, right? So we have a similar yeah. like voice. Like, if yeah. I could pick a voice, it wouldn't be his. you know, it'd probably be like someone like Mike Patton, you know, or like Freddie Mercury, right. if I could pick a voice, you know.
Right. But, yeah. No, that was yeah. That's a great track. It's so filled with energy. It's filled with starts and stops, the little bits of kind of vocalization. You know, you go from a scream, literally from a scream to a whisper to a kind of complaint. Oh my God! And then the scream comes back again. I really like that. And in complete contrast to the previous two tracks, which were. The first track was two chords. The second track was multi-layered textural stuff. This is a highly... It may not have been during the compositional process, but it's a highly structured piece by the time we get to listen to it, which you've obviously had to put a great deal of work in. That's a monster to mix something like that.
It is. Yeah, it's a lot of shoehorns involved.
Yeah, there's a lot of work goes into something like that, I know.